Good day, Sun Sound listeners. This is Janet Martin. I'll be reading portions of the Arizona Daily Star. It is January 8th, 2025, Wednesday. Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services writes, Arizona lawmaker wants to ask voters for a raise. We're not digging ditches here. A state lawmaker wants to give voters a new chance to decide if he and his colleagues are worth more than the $24,000 annual salary they now get for what are supposed to be part-time jobs. Senator John Kavanaugh, a Fountain Hills Republican, is proposing a measure for the 2026 ballot to add an automatic inflation adjustment. If voters approve, lawmakers would get an annual boost every year tied to the Consumer Price Index. Unlike the current system, lawmakers would never again have to seek voter approval for future pay hikes. Kavanaugh, the longest continuing serving legislator, acknowledge that voters have had multiple chances in the past to decide the $24,000 figure approved in the 1998 is too low. But they turned down each effort, most recently a 2014 proposal to set the figure at $35,000. He said this is different because it would use the current salary as a base and then just make annual adjustments. So, had his proposal been in effect now, the lawmakers being sworn in next week would get a $648 raise based on the most recent CPI report, which pegged inflation at 2.7%. Even though being a lawmaker is considered a half-time gig, Kavanaugh says lawmakers have been meeting most years from January into at least May, despite a 100-day deadline to get their work done each year. Plus, there are hearings and other meetings throughout the year. That precludes many legislators from having outside jobs. There aren't many people looking around for half-time workers, he said. Kavanaugh said he really thinks the salary should be $48,000 based on inflation since their last raise. He said that would not be unreasonable, even if it is higher than the median income for Arizonans, because it's based on the responsibilities lawmakers have. I mean, we're not digging ditches. We're not working a fast food restaurant line, Kavanaugh said. He also thinks it's justified to take voters out of the equation for the future if they approve this plan. Very often, the mood of the public based on other events the legislators associated with sometimes determines whether they're for us or against us, he said. Put another way, his plan would make irrelevant whether voters like or hate what lawmakers are doing at the moment. Under the Arizona Constitution, voters get the last word on legislative salaries. The Commission on Salaries for Elective State Officers is supposed to meet on a biennial basis. Among its tasks is to make recommendations for legislative salaries and ask voters to approve them. The panel did make such recommendations in 2000, 2002, 2004, 2006, and 2008. All rejected by voters. When Republican Jan Brewer was governor during the Great Recession, she refused to name members to the panel for 4 years, saying it was inappropriate to consider pay hikes for elected officials during difficult times. She did make selections in time for the 2014, though. She was openly opposed that proposal to boost pay to $35,000. It fared even worse than the others, with just 32% of voters favoring the plan. While the salary is just $24,000, there are other perks. The minimum per diem allowance for expenses is $35 a day for those living in Maricopa County for what is supposed to be a 100-day session. In essence, that's a payment for going to the Capitol in Phoenix, though they also get the allowance for weekends and other days the legislature is not in session. The figure gets cut to $10 a day after 120 days. Out-county lawmakers get a figure equal to the Federal General Services Administration rate, the number used by the federal government to reimburse employees on the road. That is currently about $250 a day, covering both lodging and an allowance for meals. Then there's the pension. For those first elected to any office before 2012, it can hit 80% of what they were earning after 20 years. There are lower benefits for newly elected officers. There's also a sweetener for those who move from the legislative to other elective office. Their benefits are calculated on the highest 5 years of their earnings. So, a lawmaker who served 16 years at the Capitol at $24,000, but then became the state treasurer at $70,000, would be entitled to a pension of $52,500 after 5 years on the new job, plus annual cost of living adjustments. President-elect refuses to rule out force to take over Greenland Canal. Trump talks of using military. President-elect Donald Trump said Tuesday he will not rule out the use of military force to seize control of the Panama Canal and Greenland, as he declared U.S. control of both to be vital to American national security. Speaking to reporters less than 2 weeks before he takes office on January 20, and as a delegation of aides and advisors that included Donald Trump Jr. is in Greenland, Trump left open the use of American military to secure both territories. Trump's intention marks a rejection of decades of U.S. policy that prioritized self-determination over territorial expansion. "I'm not going to commit to that," Trump said, when asked if he would rule out the use of military. "It might be that you'll have to do something. The Panama Canal is vital to our country," he added. "We need Greenland for national security purposes." Greenland, home to a large U.S. military base, is an autonomous territory of Denmark, a longtime U.S. ally and a founding member of NATO. Trump cast doubt on the legitimacy of Denmark's claim to Greenland. The U.S. returned the Panama Canal Zone to the Central American country in 1979 and ended its joint partnership in controlling the strategic waterway in 1999. Addressing Trump's comments in an interview with Danish broadcaster TV2, Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen called the U.S. the United States Denmark's most important and closest ally, and that she did not believe that the United States will use military or economic power to secure control over Greenland. Frederiksen said she welcomes the United States taking a greater interest in the Arctic region, but that it would have to be done in a way that is respectful of the Greenlandic people. At the same time, it must be done in a way that allows Denmark and the United States to still cooperate in, among other things, NATO's, she said. Earlier, Trump posted a video of his private plane landing in Nuuk, the Arctic territory's capital, in a landscape of snow-capped peaks and fjords. "Don Jr. and my reps landing in Greenland," Trump wrote. "The reception has been great. They and the free world need safety, security, strength, and peace. This is a deal that must happen. MAGA, make Greenland great again." In a statement, Greenland's government said Donald Trump Jr.'s visit was taking place as a private individual and not as an official visit, and Greenlandic representatives would not meet with him. Trump, a Republican, has floated having Canada join the United States as the 51st state. He said Tuesday he would not use military force to invade the country, which is home to more than 40 million people and a founding NATO partner. Instead, he said, he would rely on economic force as he cast the U.S. trade deficit with Canada, a natural resource-rich nation that provides the U.S. with commodities like crude oil and petroleum, as a subsidy that would come to an end. Canadian leaders fired back after earlier dismissing Trump's rhetoric as a joke. President-elect Trump's comments show a complete lack of understanding what makes Canada a strong country. Our economy is strong. Our people are strong. We will never back down in the face of threats, Canadian Foreign Minister Melanie Joly said on social media. Justin Trudeau, the country's outgoing prime minister, was even more blunt. "There isn't a snowball's chance in hell that Canada will become part of the United States," he wrote. Promising a golden age of America, Trump also said he will try to rename the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America, saying it has a beautiful ring to it. He also said he believes that NATO should dramatically increase its spending targets, with members of the Transatlantic Alliance committing to spend at least 5% of their GDPs on defense spending, up from the current 2%. In June, NATO announced a record 23 of its 32 member nations were on track to hit the 2% target as Russia's ongoing war in Ukraine raised the threat of expanding conflict in Europe. Trump also used this news conference to complain that President Joe Biden was undermining his transition to power a day after the incumbent moved to ban offshore energy drilling in most federal waters. Biden, whose term expires in 2 weeks, used his authority under the federal Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act to protect offshore areas along the east and west coasts, the eastern Gulf of Mexico, and portions of Alaska's North Bering Sea from future oil and natural gas leasing. All told, about 625 million acres of federal waters were withdrawn from energy exploration by Biden in a move that might require an act of Congress to undo. "I'm going to put it back on day one," Trump told reporters. He pledged to take it to the courts if we need to. Trump said Biden's efforts, part of a series of final actions in office by the Democrats' administration, was undermining his plan for once he's in office. "You know, they told me that we're going to do everything possible to make this transition to the new administration very smooth," Trump said. "It's not smooth." But Biden's team has extended access and courtesies to the Trump team that the Republican former president initially denied Biden after his 2020 election victory. Trump's incoming chief of staff, Susie Wiles, told Axios in an interview published Monday that Biden's chief of staff, Jeff Zients, has been very helpful. Mayor Raheena Romero touted the city's efforts to address social, economic, and climate ills Tuesday in her annual Report to Tucsonian speech, while also calling on the passage of a half-cent sales tax in March. Five topics that align with issues included in the sales tax plan were emphasized by Romero: affordable housing and homelessness, support for first responders, better roads, infrastructure, and park improvements, and community safety and resources. "The city has taken bold action grounded in evidence-based, data-driven decision-making over the past year to address major challenges," Romero told the crowd gathered at the Tucson Convention Center. "They include a housing crisis, a climate crisis, an opioid and fentanyl crisis, the growing number of unsheltered individuals, and an aging infrastructure." She also said it was important to recognize what is working and what we should continue investing in. Strategic action plans like the city's Resilient Together Climate Action Plan, its housing affordability strategy, or the prosperity initiative the city and county adopted in late 2023 were created to help us craft policies and ordinances needed to move Tucson forward, to allocate funding, and most importantly, to implement bringing better services and resources to Tucsonians, she said. This implementation, however, will have to be supplemented mainly through a half-cent sales voters are set to decide in March. Proposition 414, the ballot measure dubbed a safe and vibrant city, would raise the city sales tax from 8.7% to 9.2%. It is projected to raise about $80 million a year if approved by voters. The higher tax rate would last 10 years. A federal judge temporarily blocked the public release of special counsel Jack Smith's report on investigations into Donald Trump on Tuesday as an appeals court weighs a challenge to the disclosure of a much-anticipated document just days before the president-elect reclaims office. The ruling from U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon could represent a short-lived victory for Trump, but it's nonetheless the latest instance of the Trump-appointed jurist taking action in the Republicans' favor. The halt followed an emergency request Monday by defense lawyers to block the release of the report that they claimed would be one-sided and prejudicial. Poll: GOP trust in election accuracy jumps. A majority of Republicans say they are confident in the 2024 vote count after Donald Trump's win, according to a new poll that finds a sharp turnaround from GOP's voters' skepticism about U.S. elections after the president-elect spent 4 years lying about his loss to President Joe Biden. About 6 in 10 Republicans said they have a great deal or quite a bit confidence that votes in last year's presidential election were counted correctly nationwide, according to the poll from the Associated Press NORAC Center for Public Affairs Research. That's a sharp increase from about 2 in 10 Republicans who were confident in an AP NORC poll in October. About two-thirds of Republicans in a new survey said they were confident in their state's vote count, up from 4 in 10 before the election. The rockets from Gaza have mostly fallen silent. A ceasefire with Hezbollah militants in Lebanon has taken hold. But repeated fire from Yemen's Houthi rebels, a faraway foe, is proving a stubborn threat for Israel. The Iran-backed Houthis are stepping up their missile attacks, sending hundreds of thousands of Israelis scrambling for shelter in the middle of the night, scaring away foreign airlines and keeping up what could be the last major front in the Middle East wars. It's like musical chairs, said Yon Yovel, 31, who left the northern Israeli city of Haifa last year to avoid rocket from Hezbollah, only to see his apartment in Tel Aviv's Jaffa neighborhood heavily damaged by a Houthi missile. Israel has repeatedly bombarded ports, oil infrastructure, and airport in Houthi-held capital Sana'a, some 1,200 miles away. Israeli leaders have threatened to kill central Houthi figures and have tried to galvanize the world against the threat. But the Houthis persist. In recent weeks, missiles and drones from Yemen have struck nearly every day, including early Friday morning, setting off air raid sirens in broad swaths of Israel. In some cases, the projectiles have penetrated Israeli's sophisticated aerial defense system, most recently toppling an empty school and shattering the windows of apartments near an empty playground where one missile landed. Two bodies were found in a landing gear compartment of a JetBlue aircraft at a South Florida airport, the latest security breach involving the nation's aviation system, authorities said. The bodies were discovered in the wheel well area during a routine post-flight inspection Monday night at Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport. The airline said in a statement to the Associated Press, the aircraft arrived in Fort Lauderdale shortly after 11 p.m. from JFK International Airport in New York. At this time, the identities of the individuals and the circumstances surrounding how they accessed the aircraft remain under investigation, JetBlue said. This is a heartbreaking situation, and we are committed to working closely with authorities to support the efforts to understand how this occurred, the airline added. Paramedics declared both people dead at the scene, the Broward County Sheriff's Office said Tuesday. The agency's homicide and crime scene units are investigating it. Both are believed to be men, said Carrie Codd, a spokesperson for the Broward County Sheriff's Office. Beyond that, their identities at this point are unknown, and that is some of the information that Broward Sheriff's Office detectives are trying to sort out at this point. Though its most recent flight was from New York to Fort Lauderdale, the jet was in both Kingston, Jamaica, and Salt Lake City, Utah, earlier on Monday, according to flight tracking service FlightAware.com. Authorities haven't said where they think the people got into the wheel well. In Jamaica, the plane's recent stop in the Caribbean nation gave rise to speculation that the people could be Jamaican, a government official said on social media. However, our information to date is this matter still remains unclear, and there is no immediate basis on which to conclude that they are Jamaicans, Kamina Smith, Minister of Foreign Affairs and Foreign Trade of Jamaica, said in a post on social platform X. Autopsies are planned for both bodies to determine how they died, Cobb said. U.S. regulators opened an investigation into 2.6 million Teslas after reports of crashes involving the use of company technology that allows drivers to remotely command their vehicle to return to them or move to another location using a phone app. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration also said Tuesday that Tesla failed to report any of the accidents. Tesla is under order to report crashes on publicly accessible roads involving vehicles being operated through its autonomous driving technology. The new investigation follows another probe into the company's full self-driving system launched in October after reports of crashes in low visibility conditions included one that killed a pedestrian. That investigation covers 2.4 million Teslas from the 2016 through 2024 model years. Tesla did not respond to requests for comment on Tuesday. Unpaid medical bills will no longer appear on credit reports, where they can block people from mortgages, car loans, or small business loans, according to a final rule announced Tuesday by the Biden administration. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau rule will remove $49 billion in medical debt from the credit reports of more than 15 million Americans, according to the Bureau, which means lenders will no longer be able to take into consideration when deciding to issue a loan. The Biden administration plans to announce a final weapons aid package for Ukraine totaling $4 billion when Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin visits Germany on Thursday, two senior defense officials said. The Justice Department asked a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday to block a plea agreement for accused 9/11 mastermind Khalid Shaikh Mohammed and the two co-defendants that would spare them the risk of a death penalty. A statewide grand jury convened at the request of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis to investigate any and all wrongdoing regarding COVID-19 vaccines did not find evidence of criminal activity, according to a report unsealed Tuesday. Almost 44 years after Jimmy Carter left the nation's capital following a humbling defeat, the 39th president returned to Washington for 3 days of state funeral rites starting Tuesday. Carter, who died December 29th at the age of 100, will receive a state funeral Thursday at Washington National Cathedral. Biden will deliver a eulogy. President-elect Donald Trump is still scheduled to be sentenced in his hush money case this week after New York appeals court judge swiftly rejected his second attempt Tuesday to get it called off. Judge Ellen Gessmer of the state's mid-level appellate court denied Trump's request to indefinitely postpone sentencing and halt the case while he appeals the decision last week upholding the verdict. Gessmer's ruling leaves Trump's sentencing on schedule for Friday, though he can still ask other courts to intervene. His lawyers have been fighting for months to have a federal court seize control of the case. The judge's one-sentence decision didn't give reasons for the denial. The fast-moving appeals court's developments came after the trial judge Juan M. Merchan rebuffed Trump's first attempt Monday. Trump was convicted in May on charges involving an alleged scheme to hide a hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels in the last weeks of Trump's 2016 campaign to keep her from publicizing claims she had sex with him years earlier. He claims he did nothing wrong. Firefighters scrambled to corral a fast-moving wildfire in the Los Angeles hillside, dotted with celebrity homes, as a potentially life-threatening destructive windstorm hit Southern California on Tuesday, fanning the blaze seen for miles. About 30,000 residents are under evacuation orders. More than 13,000 structures are under threat, said Christine Crowley, fire chief of the LA Fire Department. Forecasters warn the worst may be yet to come, with the windstorm predicted to last for days, producing isolated gusts that could top 100 miles per hour in mountains and the foothills. Flora's Market Run, the grocery store and restaurant that replaced the historic Rincon Market on East 6th Street in mid-2021, abruptly closed Tuesday. A note on the front door announced that the business was closing at 3 p.m. Monday, but there was no indication that the closure was permanent. The company also made no formal announcement on social media. Owners Nathan Ayers of Ayers Collective, Prep and Pastry, Commoner & Company, said the decision to close came after months of hand-wringing as the store tried to find its niche. Over the 3 years that it was open, Ayers said he pivoted to the idea that included reducing the grocery footprint and expanding the restaurant and grab-and-go option. I even did a juice bar and a bunch of other items, and nothing just seemed to really stick with the climate of the economy, he said. Nothing was landing, so I just had to make the hard decision. I find myself walking away from what was really a fun passion project. Ayers said he notified the store's employees a week ago about the closing and found them jobs with his other companies and restaurants. Ayers Collective took over the former Rincon Market space located at 2513 East 6th Street in October 2020, months after the market closed during the COVID-19 pandemic. An appeals court has temporarily stopped Pima Community College from raising three historic Tucson motels that need expensive renovations in a ruling Monday that gives preservationists time to appeal a lower court's decision in PCC's favor. The college has until January 15th to respond to the preservationist petition, the Arizona Court of Appeals ruled. The decision came a month after Pima County Superior Court Judge Brennan J. Griffin rejected the Tucson Historic Preservation Foundation's bid for a preliminary injunction blocking the demolition. The PCC Governing Board unanimously voted in November against restoring the motels for a cost of $35.7 million and to instead demolish them at an estimated cost of $500,000 while trying to preserve the motel's neon signs. Two of the board members, Luis Gonzalez and Maria de Garcia, lost the re-election bids on November 5th and are being replaced this month by Carla Morales and Kristen Randall. The other members are Wade McLean, Teresa Rye, and Greg Taylor. Pima County Administrator John Lesher got a raise as part of a new two-year contract approved Tuesday by the Board of Supervisors. The contract, which outlines her salary, benefits, and contract terms, will increase Lesher's annual salary by approximately 27%, from $260,000 a year to $330,000. The vote occurred shortly after the swear-in ceremony for the board. Democrat Rex Scott will serve as the board's chairman. Terms of the contracts apply from January 8th through January 7th, 2027, with the option to renew the contract two additional periods, up to one each year. Lesher has been the county administrator since April 2022. If you've been thinking about buying a marijuana dispensary in Arizona, now might be a good time. The value of dispensary licenses in the state has plummeted to its lowest point since the mid-2010s, amid an industry-wide revenue slump that has meant smoking deals for customers. Starting in July, sales at state-licensed marijuana dispensaries began an unprecedented slide, falling below $100 million per month for the first time in years, Arizona Department of Revenue numbers show. October's numbers reversed the trend mildly as the industry moves into its fall high season, but overall revenue remained relatively low at $92.2 million in combined medical and recreational sales, an 18% decrease over last October. Reported prices for Arizona dispensary licenses are down from $10 to $20 million to roughly $7 to $12 million. With numerous challenges facing the industry, it's still a lot of money for would-be dispensary owners to risk. Total overcultivation has occurred, said Steve Cottrell, who helped author the state's 2020 recreational marijuana initiative when he was president and CEO of Curaleaf. A lot of people are going out of business over the next year because they cannot sell their product. The Arizona trend benefits buyers of marijuana flower, vape pen cartridges, gummies, and other THC-infused products which are going for significantly lower cost at some stores. Cannabis is cheaper than ever, Cottrell said. Pricing for consumers is way down. It's not only dispensaries feeling the loss either. Marijuana tax revenue that helps fund community colleges, local police agencies, and more has also taken a hit. For cannabis consumers and would-be owners of the state's limited array of dispensary, it's a buyer's market. Observers and industry insiders don't agree on the cause of the revenue decline, but focus on a couple of major factors. Some say there's too much marijuana in the market and too much supply is driving prices down. Others blame the intoxicating hemp market, which offers similar products due to what some consider a loophole in federal law. Another factor might be the expansion of Arizona's dispensary market last year, when most of the 26 socially equity licenses snapped up by major cannabis companies turned into storefronts and cultivation facilities. In September 2023, just before the state deadline for social equity license holders to open their business, the state had 169 licenses and 148 operating marijuana retail sellers. That jumped up to 168, the current number of stores, by November 2023. Most are concentrated near freeways in Metro Phoenix and Tucson. Meanwhile, Arizonans paid slightly more in 2024 for food and other items. They paid less for cannabis products this year, according to data firm Headset.io. The price of an average item purchased from a dispensary decreased roughly 7% from November 2023 to the same month this year, the firm reported. A man claiming to have suffered third-degree burns after Phoenix police held his bare torso to the ground for several minutes while detaining him last summer has filed notice of a claim against the city demanding over $15 million. The claim, which the Arizona Republic attained through the city of Phoenix, states four officers questioned detained 30-year-old Michael Kenyon on July 6, 2024, which had a recorded high of 114 degrees before they held him face down on black asphalt for roughly 4 minutes, leaving serious burns across his body. The claim includes pictures of Kenyon lying on a hospital bed with severe burns along his arms, chest, and legs. According to the claim, Kenyon's roommate called Phoenix police shortly before 2 p.m. that day to report that his laptop had been stolen and believed the suspect to be 5 feet 5 inches tall and may have possessed pepper spray. The claim says Kenyon was at home when his roommate reported the nonviolent theft and decided to walk to nearby Circle K to buy a drink as he didn't expect police to respond to reports of nonviolent property theft. The claim then states that Kenyon was walking across the parking lot towards the store when Phoenix officers pulled up behind him in a police vehicle and told him to come back. The document says Kenyon complied and answered the officer's questions before the officer grabbed both of his arms within 5 seconds of their initial contact. The claim noted that Kenyon is 5 feet 10 inches tall and did not match the suspect description his roommate police gave. All four officers piled on top of Michael, pressing him against the scalding hot pavement, the claim reads. As Michael screamed out for help, the officers pressed hard, one officer at one point kneeling on his head and pressing the side of his face into the asphalt as other officers put their weight on his torso. Dan Wilson, a city spokesperson, declined to comment on the notice of claim, citing pending litigation. Sergeant Phil Krensky, a Phoenix Police spokesperson, said the department's Special Investigation Division was still reviewing the involved officer's actions as of Monday evening. From the opinion page, Rick Rappaport makes a Tucson opinion. Arizona businesses must support climate strategies. You might think the Republican majorities in the Arizona House and Senate and the Republican 5-0 dominance in the Arizona Corporation Commission would bode well for businesses. After all, good for business has been the Republican mantra for years and years. But what is really good for business is the ability to anticipate and forecast future outcomes based on the past and current data. That is business planning 101. So, if you know your business rates are going to rise 3 to 4% this year, and you can factor that into a 5-year plan to see what you need to do to maintain profitability. But what if they go up 25% in 1 year, and the next year 13%? What if you can't even get insurance and have to self-insure? What if your employees can't find housing because skyrocketing construction costs make new housing unaffordable and renting housing markets tighter than a tourniquet? What if you have to dramatically increase what you pay employees in order to cover the shortage of skilled help? And what about the cost of goods in your manufacturing? Are those costs really foreseeable with every one of your vendors and supply chain participants experiencing the exact same thing, making their costs and planning just as unpredictable? As climate activists were cautioned against even using the word climate change, people became numb upon hearing those words. And don't even bring up data numbers. People respond and will turn against the messenger. Yes, I do understand. The Yankees' loss to the Dodgers in the World Series was not because of climate change. I'll concede that. But all those wildly unpredictable business costs are due to the unforbidden word, climate change. You think just the people in North Carolina and Florida are going to pay for Hurricane Helene and Milton's estimated $55 billion cost and $100 billion economic losses? Only in those unfortunate states will the insurance rates and the construction costs go up, but here in Arizona you're safe? Ask any homeowner or rental property owner in Arizona, pick one, anyone, and get their take on what is more like an insurance crisis here than anything else. And when these catastrophes hit, they put pressure on all manner of costs, everywhere, not just where the tragedy struck. I mean, when China went on a public spree to rapidly urbanize the country, they used more concrete in 3 years than the U.S. did in the entire 20th century. You don't think there are going to be those kind of dramatic market and supply pressures as the climate crisis continues here in Arizona and elsewhere? And yes, everything you do to mitigate climate change helps, every little thing. You can't stop it, but you can slow it down. And what matters to every living thing on this planet, animals, plants, and humans. Tell me how to plan around your energy costs when the ACC has authorized an automatic, no hearings, no public input, rate rise for any utility incurring highly fluctuating coal, oil, or gas prices. Your business costs are hogtied to the Middle East. How's that predictability working for you? Tell me how you plan around your insurance costs when there is not a hint of climate mitigation coming out of the Arizona legislature. In fact, the opposite, as bill after bill to institute any kind of climate mitigation never even gets a hearing. Arizona businesses must get out of the ideology game and into the game of planning for our own viability. You might find yourself with strange bedfellows, climate activists, but the biggest Arizona business sectors, healthcare, transportation, housing, construction, and manufacturing, are all dramatically affected right now, right in this moment, by climate change. Business must support climate mitigation strategies. Business cannot pass on all these costs to consumers. It's impossible. What's left is an existential Arizona business crisis, and there's not a moment to lose to stop that from happening. Gene Robinson from the Washington Post writes, President-elect Donald Trump has promised the mass deportation of undocumented migrants, and now we know how this will look. Ugly, wrenching, heartbreaking, and cruel. During his first term, Trump shocked the nation's conscience by separating children from their parents or guardians and housing the minors in cages. This time, the president-elect's plan is to hold entire families together in tents. Undocumented parents whose children were born in the United States and have citizenship will have to choose whether to be deported together as a family or leave their children behind. Migrants without papers who have built new lives in this country will be apprehended in their homes and at their workplaces. National Guard troops likely will not be used to conduct these raids, but instead transport detainees to the centers where they will be held. Trump's incoming border czar, Tom Horman, gave his sketch of what we will soon witness in a wide-ranging interview with the Washington Post on Thursday. In previous remarks, Horman had promised a shock and awe campaign against undocumented migrants. When the roundups get underway, the military transports start rolling and the tent city detention centers will begin to fill. No one will be able to say we were not warned. It is undeniably true that the southern border is a mess and the whole U.S. immigration system is dysfunctional. This has been the case for decades under Democrat and Republican presidents. The solution has also been obvious for decades. We need comprehensive reform that secures the border, provides viable paths for legal migration, offers asylum to those seen as legitimately fleeing oppression or life-threatening violence, provides legal status to the dreamers who were brought here as children and know no other country, acknowledges that uprooting and expelling an estimated 11 million undocumented migrants, almost all of them leading productive lives, would be an unrealistic exercise in national self-harm. All of that is clear, but it's also clear that Trump sends them all home. Demagoguery on immigration has been the most consistent theme throughout his three presidential campaigns. This year it appealed not only to the far-right xenophobic fringe, but also to many other voters who were dismayed by scenes of lawless chaos along the border. As Trump found out while in office, however, rhetoric eventually collides with reality. Mexico did not pay for his border wall, which went mostly unbuilt, and some measures, mostly American, were not willing two continents. Homan found out too, as Trump's acting director of immigration and customs enforcement, he implemented the infamous zero tolerance policy that separated more than 5,000 children from their parents and guardians, often shipping the youngest hundreds of miles away and not even bothering to carefully track who was sent where. That time, Trump and Homan had to back down. This time, they will test the nation's tolerance for seeing families held for extended periods in tents, and parents having to decide whether the only way to guarantee safety and opportunity for their U.S.-born children is to leave them here with no guarantee of seeing them again. In his interview with The Post, Nick Muroff, Homan did not echo Trump in challenging those children's birthright citizenship or their unequivocal status as Americans, but Homan expressed no sympathy for their parents. "Here's the issue," he said. "You knew you were in this country illegally and chose to have a child, so you put your family in that position. Your fault. You can say goodbye and be deported without them, or you can all be deported together. Just go." Homan said he and his incoming team haven't really worked out the plan for worksite enforcement, the workplace raids carried out by immigration enforcement officers that will swoop up undocumented migrants who are contributing to the economy and often doing jobs that businesses struggle to fill. "We know that employers are going to be upset," Homan said in an understatement. President Joe Biden halted such raids. It would be disingenuous, however, to pretend that the Biden administration did a good job handling the border. The chaotic influx of asylum seekers was indeed a crisis until Biden belatedly cracked down this year. It would also be disingenuous to claim Biden had the legislative framework, personnel, and facilities that would be needed to manage a sensible and orderly immigration flow. Voters who saw something more like an uncontrolled flood were not wrong. But Trump's planned measures are punitive rather than remedial. People who hacked their lives through the jungles of Panama and walked the length of Mexico for the chance to work and to forge a better life for their families are not rapists or murderers or bad hombres, as Trump called them. Given the chance, a lot of them would surely become Republicans. Chris Pasco from the Arizona Daily Star writes, "Wildcats adjust to Big 12 scenery." While the first game of Arizona's initial Big 12 road trip took equipment manager Brian Brigger back to his hometown of Cincinnati, the second game did the same for athletic trainer Justin Kolesky. Almost Kolesky grew up just over an hour away in suburban Pittsburgh, attending West Allegheny High School and becoming intimately familiar with West Virginia's campus, athletics, facilities, and culture. "I had family members that went to West Virginia, so I grew up going to Pittsburgh and West Virginia basketball and football games," Kolesky said. "It's a normal little college town, but what I appreciate about the West Virginia fans is they are diehard. I mean, they feel like they're on the team. They refer to it as we, you know, we this, we that, whether it's going to football or basketball. There's nothing like growing up and going to a West Virginia football game. When there's a West Virginia football game and you get those fans, that's the biggest population in the state at one time." Kolesky even compared the Mountaineers fans to those of the Pittsburgh Steelers, whose presence famously prompts churches to schedule Sunday services around game times. Despite all that, Kolesky wound up graduating instead from the University of Pittsburgh because, well, finances. "I would have gone to West Virginia if it wasn't out of state," Kolesky said. "I really liked the campus. I thought it was cool. But I didn't want to pay out of state tuition." Kolesky got an undergraduate degree in sports medicine from Pitt in 2000, arrived at the University of Arizona later that year, and then completed a master's degree at the university in 2002. Standing outside or camping in the 20-degree temperatures wasn't required for West Virginia's Mountaineer Maniac student fans Tuesday. In fact, seniors Marla Davis and James McKay just walked right in and took seats in the first row 90 minutes before Tuesday's game. Since West Virginia is on winter break this week, student ticket demand was lower than normal. But Davis and McKay said they normally still only have to show up 2 hours before games to make sure they get the best seats. "It's not that extreme, McKay said. McKay said it was good to see Arizona join the Big 12 because it's a great basketball school, and the Maniacs who were on hand were given some reasons to jeer at the Wildcats via their musings sheet left on each student section seat. Love was featured in the Burn of the Game section with a profile of sorts. With Armani Beauty in his corner, he mastered the art of looking flawless post-game, even when the scoreboard disagrees, the musing said of Love. In adding breakdowns for supporting UA players, it noted that Anthony Del Orso went from being a fighting camel at Campbell to fighting for points, and the transition hasn't been kind, while saying Trey Townsend's aim isn't quite as sharp, and when he threw out the opening pitch at a Detroit Tigers game. Ryan Hansen got to enjoy the Bahamas while working at the radio station during Arizona's first matchup with the West Virginia this season. In the battle for Atlantis, Reggie Gary was assigned to analyze the rematch in the snowy Morgantown. "That's just how it works, exactly," Gary said, smiling. "Actually, it was nothing against Gary, but just because Hansen covers road games when he can only miss minimal work time, and he was escorting traveling fans in the Bahamas in his day job as Bon Voyage's COO, while Gary covers the remaining road games while working with his university developmental job remotely." "As it turns out," Gary said before Tuesday's game, "that the trip went well." He said visiting Cincinnati was enjoyable, while work and gym occupied his time in Morgantown. Accompanying the Wildcats on both games this week, Tucson businessman Paul Vope took a detour to pay homage to his father. Vope was born in Tucson, but his father, James, was a high school sports star in Ponawah Point, Ohio, and chose to be buried there. So Paul rented a car and made the snowy 90-mile drive in a vehicle that was fortunately all-wheel drive to visit the gravesite. Arizona timed its flights well throughout the trip, flying from Cincinnati to Morgantown just before a storm hit and not leaving Morgantown until after it subsided. But the Wildcats did have to make one tiring concession. Their scheduled flight out of nearby Clarksburg was moved to Pittsburgh late Tuesday night, meaning the Wildcats would need a 90-minute drive to the airport and 4-hour flight after that. Arizona's expected arrival time was 3 a.m. Wednesday. However, the Wildcats were expected to be able to sleep in. They were scheduled to have Wednesday off from practice and aren't in school either. While the Pac-12 occasionally sent its teams on extended trips where they would play two games with two full days between each, usually Wednesday and Saturday or Thursday and Sunday, the two-game Big 12 version assigned to Arizona this week wasn't the same to point guard Jaden Bradley. "It's definitely a different environment," Bradley said. "For a lot of guys, it's different seeing these arenas. I never thought I'd be in Cincinnati. I like that arena. And West Virginia's? I don't know. It was that big an arena. And for some of our guys, it was the first time seeing the snow." Not only does West Virginia have two obligatory display cases dedicated to legendary former Mountaineer star Jerry West, but the team also featured him in a pregame video. "I competed for the state and the people at West Virginia, not just the university," West said. The big number, 8 inches of new snow around WVU Coliseum since the Mountaineers played Oklahoma State on Saturday. What's quotable? "I think the biggest thing is we went from 80 degrees to 20 degrees. That's a big adjustment," the West Virginia coach Darian DeVries on the difference between facing Arizona in the Bahamas on November 29th and Tuesday in Morgantown. Tucson Hockey Community Grows in Tucson, a story by Elvira Vertigo. It's a little after 8:30 p.m. on a Friday night, and Tucson Arena is the coolest place to be, literally. While the air temperature of the Tucson Arena ice rink may be between a brisk 50 and 60 degrees, things are just heating up as the Tucson Adult Hockey League is about to hit the ice for its first games back since the league's brief holiday break. As the clocks tick around the 8:40 p.m. start time of the night's first game, the Altitude Home Loans hockey team sits in their makeshift locker room behind the arena's ice rink, prepping for their match against the Tierra Antigua Reality hockey team. Behind the black curtains of the locker room, players put on their proactive padding, shin guards, and banana yellow jerseys before lacing up their skates. Among the Knights players are the father-son duo Chris Falk Sr., 49, and Chris Falk Jr., 29, lifelong hockey fans who have been a part of the league for several years. It's everything. It's what keeps me going, keeps me young, keeps me connected to him, Falk Sr. said. I don't know that I would still go through all of it if it was not for the chance to connect and share things with them. That's the biggest thing. Immediately after Falk Sr. finishes speaking about the competing with his son means to him, the entire team jokingly bursts out into collective, "Aww." The team response is playful and a little sarcastic, but showcases the fun personalities of those who dedicate time out of their busy schedules to play a game or two of hockey each week. Today, in women's basketball, the Arizona Wildcats will take on Baylor at 6 p.m. at the McHale Center. You can watch the game on ESPN Plus or listen to it on 1400 AM radio. From the food section, there is a story from the kitchen, the fluffiest French toast. Hawaiian rolls add a delicious spin to a classic breakfast fare. And they look absolutely delicious from the picture there with like syrup going over them. French toast is a breakfast classic. Serve it with a platter of crispy bacon and a fried egg and you'll be ready to greet the day. Classic French toast, or pain perdu, usually relies on day-old stale bread for its recipe. We've got our eye on another bakery find. Hawaiian sweet rolls are often reserved for savory party sliders, but these tender three-bite wonders have found their calling in French toast. In this recipe, you'll separate the rolls and quickly dip them in a velvety egg custard. That's just a fancy term for dairy plus egg. That has a drizzle of maple syrup, ground cinnamon, and vanilla extract for an irresistible flavor. Each side of the roll sizzles in butter and fries up golden brown for the perfectly plush, fluffy, and custardy French little toast. So, this is the recipe for Hawaiian roll French toast. It serves four. The ingredients are three large eggs, 3/4 cup, half and half, whole milk, heavy cream, or a combination. 1 tablespoon maple syrup, plus more for serving. 1 teaspoon vanilla extract, 1/4 teaspoon cinnamon, 1 pinch kosher salt, 1 12-ounce package of Hawaiian sweet rolls such as King's, 2 tablespoons unsalted butter divided plus more for serving, and powdered sugar for serving, which is optional. Whisk the eggs, dairy of choice, 1 tablespoon maple syrup, vanilla extract, cinnamon, and salt together in a wide, shallow pan like a pie dish until combined and no streaks of the egg remain. Separate the Hawaiian rolls. Place each of the rolls into a single layer on a cut side into the egg mixture. Quickly soak all 4 cut sides, about 30 seconds per side. The top and the bottom of the roll do not need to soak. The rolls should hold their shape and not be soggy or falling apart. Transfer to a plate. Melt 1 tablespoon of butter in a large nonstick skillet over medium heat. Add the soaked roll bottom side down in a single layer with space around each one. Cook, turning occasionally until the bottom and all 4 sides are golden brown, about 2 minutes per side. No need to cook the top of the roll. If the rolls are getting too dark, reduce the heat to medium-low and transfer to a serving plate. Soak the remaining rolls, then melt the remaining 1 tablespoon unsalted butter in the pan before cooking the second batch. Serve with powdered sugar or more maple syrup. Refrigerate leftovers in an airtight container for up to 4 days, so you can make this to be eaten during the week. On Nutrition has the article Smart Goals for a New Year. A few weeks ago, I had coffee with a friend who used to share an office with me where we both worked as dietitians. I asked if she was busy. Not really, she said. No one wants to talk about nutrition or weight loss during the holidays, but it will definitely pick up after January 1. So true, the New Year's when we start over, and for many of us that often means some type of health goal. One thing I've learned from personal and professional experience is this: without a specific plan of action, most resolutions are nothing more than a hope that falls by the website at the wayside at the first sign of stress or Dunkin' Donuts. So, how do we do these grand plans for the coming year? Check out the internet and you'll see a lot of advice on how to set SMART goals. I happen to believe this is a great place to start any new venture, especially when it comes to our diet or health. Let's say your goal is to lose weight and get in better physical shape this year. That's pretty general. Using the SMART acronym to set your goal may enhance your ability to actually reach it. This is what it means. S in SMART, specific. What specifically will I do to reach this goal? Example, I will walk around the park for 30 minutes at least 3 days a week and eat at least 2 cups of different kinds of vegetables today. Measurable. How will M for measurable? How will I measure my goals? Example, I will track my walking times and vegetable servings on my phone or calendar. A, as in achievable. Can I really do this? What will I have to give up to meet the goals? This is where reality hits. R for realistic. Is that a reasonable goal? Is it possible for me to achieve? If not, rewrite your goal. T, time limited. Example, I will follow this routine for one month and then reevaluate my goal based on my success. I made a couple of New Year goals. I will eat 2 fresh vegetables stored in my fridge every day before they start to shrivel and will keep track on my wall calendar. I will also join my husband for a walk down our mile road at least 2 days a week unless there's a blizzard or the cows get out. Seriously though, it's a great time of year to evaluate our values and take note of what is most important in our life. In the words of 2 anonymous authors, may your New Year's resolutions last longer than your holiday leftovers, and may your resolution to hit the gym result in at least 1 push-up. Lastly, in the words of the singer-songwriter Brad Paisley, tomorrow is the first blank page of a 365-page book. Write a good one. Weather-wise, today will be partly to mostly cloudy and windy with a high of 54 degrees, with winds from the east at 25 to 35 miles per hour. Winds could occasionally gust over 40 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy skies with a low of 36 degrees with winds in the southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Generally, tomorrow there will be generally sunny with a high of 57 with winds from the southeast shifting to northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. The Weather Service has predicted a couple of freezes over the next couple of nights, so remember, you want to protect your pipes, your plants, and people. So bundle up and keep warm. Goodbye.